Warning: The Mended Futures podcast contains stories told by guests that may be sensitive to some people. Viewer and listener discretion is advised. The opinions expressed by guests do not reflect the views of the hosts and/or producers of this podcast.
Our guest this week is Jeffrey Snow. I was so tempted to ask him if he was related to President Jon Snow from The Hunger Games, but I decided to save him the trouble. He works for the homelessness prevention at Interfaith Outreach. And Interfaith Outreach is an organization that works along various parts of the river.
So in Jeffrey's episode, you'll hear how Interfaith Outreach intervenes at the kind of close to the waterfall part of the river and how they work upstream in prevention. And there was a lot of talk with collaborating with other organizations, which is the whole goal of this podcast, and to highlight the importance of what an everyday person can do along the river. So we're excited for you to hear it.
We hope you enjoy.
So 2025, the start of 2025 was kind of unique because in this area of the country, we had not really had any winter weather.
Since what, the 90s?
Not like this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it feels like January and February were a blur. And speaking of winter weather,
today we have Jeffrey Snow. Welcome.
Yay! Happy to be here.
I'm sure you love those jokes. I'm sure you get them all the time.
You know, the snow's fun, so I'm okay with it.
Yeah. Well, tell us about who you are.
Yeah. So my name is Jeffrey Snow. I work as the outreach coordinator with Interfaith Outreach Association. I'm going on 6 years there. My main responsibilities, I coordinate our emergency assistance and homeless prevention programs. And that keeps me pretty busy.
I'm sure.
I would imagine.
So tell us more about Interfaith Outreach.
Yeah. So Interfaith has been around quite a while in the community. Originally back in the 60s, because when people are in crisis, where do they usually call? It's usually their church. And so a group of faith leaders came together and said, a lot of people's needs are really complicated, and it would be really great if there was a specialized organization that was trained to do this. And so eventually, you know, Interfaith Outreach became its own organization in the 80s under the name Kumbaya, very much connected to Camp Kumbaya. And in the 90s, changed the name to Interfaith Outreach to better represent, you know, our mission and who we are. And so a bunch of the faith leaders and the faith people in the community, you know, are able to kind of come together and, you know, workshop, you know, so kind of centralize that helping, you know, kind of program. Over time, what we've kind of offered has evolved, you know, from what the community needs. And so right now, you know, our biggest programs are emergency assistance. We also do the homeless prevention program for Central Virginia through the Continuum of Care, our homeless response system. We also have a progressive release program where we work with ex-offenders and in the local jail system. We also have an interfaith rebuilds program where we're able to make minor home repairs to keep people safe and in their home, and a furniture and furnishings program. So we're able to provide things like beds and couches, tables, things like that when people are getting started. And we do still have our VIP program, which where we're able to do rides for our neighbors who are visually impaired. So a few different things have evolved a little bit over the years.
Yeah. That was very articulate and thorough. I'm really impressed.
And I would just say, as a listener, that is very boots on the ground work.
Practical, yeah.
In the community. Yes. Can you explain a little bit to folks listening? I always want to make sure if you don't work in whatever space it is that you understand, you know, what Jeffrey's talking about. What is emergency assistance?
Yeah. So It is kind of broad, but the way that kind of looks for us, people who receive termination notices for their utility bills or eviction notices, we can also help with things like utility deposits or towards first month's rent. So really, you're kind of in this situation where you either don't have housing or utilities or you're about to lose it. Mm-hmm. And we're able to help financially to kind of bridge that gap. So many people in our community are working, are kind of living paycheck to paycheck. And so most of the year they're fine. But, you know, I know personally, you know, I had my hot water heater break a few mm-hmm. months ago, or, you know, you start having car problems or you're sick and miss some work and now you're down a paycheck and can't pay that bill. Mm-hmm. So we're able to work with them to, you know, get them connected with other resources that they're not already and, you know, help get that situation solved. Mm-hmm. 'Cause a lot of people, since there are so many people who are, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, they don't necessarily know what resources are available. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, kind of we can help some and then also get them connected with other places in the community.
Excellent. Yeah. We use the visual of the river a lot to think about the work. The intervening work is oftentimes near the waterfall, and you can also work upstream. Mm-hmm. And I would say Interfaith is working at various places along the river. And a lot of folks are near the waterfall and are getting these eviction notices mm-hmm. and, you know, other things that are quite scary. And when you think about it financially, it's so much more efficient to keep someone housed.
Absolutely.
It is so expensive to be rehoused.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you all see that whenever utilities are terminated mm-hmm. and you have to start them again.
Yeah, so, can you explain that a little bit? I'm not sure that I sort of know what that's about.
So a lot of times, you know, you get moved in somewhere and you've had to provide all these documents and get approved for a property, and you've probably had to pay a security deposit, maybe a double security deposit, as well as that first month's rent. But if you have been evicted, it's a lot harder to find a place that will accept you. And if you do, you almost always have to pay a double security deposit.
Got it.
Not to mention, and you know, if your utilities have been turned off because you're not paying, you then have to pay that old bill plus a new deposit.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And we see a lot of people that, you know, on their paycheck to paycheck, they're able to make the bills, but at their income level might not get approved for the same type of apartment again.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can keep them there, you know, they're in safe and secure housing. And also, you know, the process of being evicted is, you know, it's a very traumatic experience.
Mm. You might lose all your furniture. You may lose
it's
everything.
The security of a roof over your head.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, family heirlooms, mm-hmm. you know, photographs, you know, important documents.
Right.
If you have to start over and find it, you know, order a new birth certificate.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And, you know, those sorts of things. It, you know, kind of compounds the issue. And, you know, there are laws in place to help students, you know, stay in their school and so they don't have to make that transition. But, you know, if you're in one area and you have family that maybe you can go stay with, you know, if you're an hour away, even if technically they will try to help you out, it mm-hmm. creates those extra barriers mm-hmm. for that family.
How did you get involved in this work?
Yeah. So I went to Lynchburg College, University of Lynchburg, for my undergraduate degree, and I got involved in a program called the Bonner Leader Program. That's like a service learning organization where students work with different nonprofits in the area. And through that, I really saw all, especially Lynchburg, I think, is so blessed with so many amazing organizations. Mm-hmm. I saw all the amazing work that was going on. I think before that, I had aspirations to be a doctor because in my head, that was the only way to help.
Mm-hmm.
But it really opened my eyes to all the different ways you can make an impact. And after I graduated undergrad, I started the nonprofit leadership master's program at the university.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to work part-time. And Interfaith had an opening for a part-time person. And so I started there fall of 2019. So got a few months.
we were just talking
about normalcy.
Yes, I don't know. We were just talking about we're coming up on the anniversary. And I
Five
don't know
years
if all the
COVID.
Listeners think about March in a very different way
mm-hmm.
post
Yep. March 14th will never be the same.
Yes, a day that will live in infamy.
Yeah.
Yes. So, you know, I'm grad student working part time. And then COVID hit and so many people no longer had their sources of income.
Mm-hmm.
And the needs just skyrocketed. And, you know, we as an organization, you know, we've tried to always be, you know, respond to the need of the community. And the state had launched a rent and mortgage relief program. And initially when we were approached, they were like, maybe $100,000. And we were like, oh, that's kind of a lot of money. Like, we're not quite sure. And 6 months later, because we administered this program locally from July to December of 2020, we spent over $2 million in direct relief to Central Virginia.
Yeah.
And I think a piece of that people don't always think about is not only the people who are renting that needed that assistance, but also then the people who own these properties that still have their bills to pay. And, you know, I think sometimes we get in our heads of these, you know, kind of major mega corporations with a million properties, but so many are just, you know, people that might own just one second property after a family member had passed and they had inherited. And, you know, now they're on their normal income now trying to make two homes work.
Yeah.
And it was very difficult. And so that kind of helped us grow a little bit, being able to respond to that need. And then that kind of opened the door a few years later when there became a need for someone to administer the homeless prevention program for our area. We had built up a lot of goodwill with properties doing that initial program, because we try, you know, we understand that, you know, timeliness does matter. And, you know, it's not just, you know, the clients that are applying with us that need help, but, you know, it kind of trickles back to other employees and other people that are relying on that kind of stream of income.
So talk to us about homeless prevention. What does it look like? And what does a day in the life look like? For you, trying to prevent something.
Yes. And so our different programs all kind of do a little bit of homelessness prevention. I'll start with the program called Homeless Prevention. That is a state-funded program, and we work through our continuum of care with that. Our community has a homeless hotline called CHIA that people can call if they are homeless or about to be homeless. And those who are about to be homeless, we then get that referral. And we're able to, you know, we don't have unlimited money, unfortunately, so they're, you know, can't help everyone, but we're able to kind of assess their situation and see, you know, what's really the barrier to either staying where you're at or gaining a new housing. And that can vary from people who are behind on their rent and needing help with that to maybe they got into an argument with their property manager and maybe there's a mediation that can help, or maybe they were living with family that have doubled up over the last few years with how expensive things have gotten. And, you know, maybe there's an argument there and we can, you know, help extend that time, or, you know, maybe they do need to look for new housing. And so we can kind of work with them and, you know, find out what's going on. And if there is something that we can, you know, kind of keep them where they're at, where they feel comfortable, that's the goal always. But if we do need to find them new housing, work with them, see what's reasonable for them. Maybe they've just lost their job and, you know, they just need a little help kind of getting over that hump. Or, you know, maybe it's a longer term situation and we can kind of work with that. Our program is, you know, shorter term, but kind of getting them set up for that success, whether that's, you know, getting on a waiting list for maybe an income-based housing or something like that and kind of bridging that gap. Kind of over the place. It's kind of professionally kind of very interesting because we, you know, it's always something a little different.
Yeah.
And people's situations are very unique. And, you know, we never leave the office going, wow, what a boring day, because there's always something going on. And, you know,
there are real stakes to it.
Yes. These are very much people's lives and their safety and security. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the housing's such that core piece of wellness. So, you know, we try to be flexible and adapt to kind of what they need. You know, we've been able to, you know, get a referral, and, you know, I'm lucky that I have an executive director that, you know, does care and is really responsive. And I'm able to come to her and say, hey, I have this household. there, meet all eligibility requirements. I need a check for this amount. Can you handwrite it for me real quick so I can run it over there before I, you know, before the sheriff gets there? Mm-hmm. And we're able to do that, which is exciting.
Yeah.
And that's how real it is. You're meeting families where they are, case by case basis. And
they're like, that's as real time as it gets.
They're in crisis.
Yes.
I want to ask you a question that's going a little bit off script. And I mentioned the visual of the river because I love that. And you're doing upstream work. What do you think is the farthest upstream that you can get? Like when you talk about the most basic of services, like, and this is an opinion question, what's the most basic of services? We think about people in need of food, people in need of medical care, people in need of housing. What do you think is the most basic thing to helping our community?
I am biased with my work, but I do think it really all comes back to home. I think that's where, you know, I think when it comes to food, you know, that's where you can prepare your food. That's where, you know, you can get a good night's rest. You know, that really kind of comes before, I think, a lot of things, because it's hard to feel, you know, nourished and rested if you, you know, don't have a place to go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I do really feel that, you know, home really is kind of paramount to it all. You know, of course, you know, your basic necessities of, you know, food and water and all that kind of things are essential.
Yeah.
But I think home really is paramount.
Yeah, totally. Since people are referred to you, it might not be as relevant as maybe I was initially thinking, but do people trust you immediately? Like, are they willing to accept your help because they're in crisis, or what's that relationship kind of like?
I think it varies. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, when you're kind of backed up against a wall, you kind of, you know, I think sometimes you're more willing to lay it all out. Mm-hmm. But I think in our community, since there are so many people, especially the last few years, that have never needed to ask for help before, I think there's a lot of, you know, I think they're scared. Mm-hmm. I think it's a scary process. I think a lot of the systems that exist are very confusing. And, you know, I think that really is why I think we try to be so connected in the community, because a lot of times if someone can vouch for you, it makes it a little easier. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think we also are able to be pretty real with people of, you know, this is why I'm asking these questions. This is what I need. I'm, you know, I just want you to navigate the system and get the help you need. And, you know, I have the only thing I'm here to do is help you get over this crisis.
Mm-hmm. Not trying to be in your business or.
Yeah.
Just trying to help.
And I think it kind of is balanced with the, you know, I can only, you know, make referrals or get connected with programs as much as I do know what's going on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as long, you know, we have certain bare minimums we can get from, you know, for our programs to be able to do what we do. And as long as they can get us that, we try to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the more open they are or able to be, kind of the more we can do from there. Mm-hmm. Because we know really what's at like the core of their problem. The more we can do to make those connections and kind of give them that hand up.
Mm-hmm. For the financial services that you guys provide, is that driven by donors or is that a government thing?
Yeah, so we try to keep, you know, pretty diverse funding. Mm-hmm. Our prevention program is a state program. Mm-hmm. Most of our funding is from donors.
Cool.
We, you know, try to reach out to foundations and donors. And, you know, when a grant does come up, we try to reach out to it to make it happen.
And so, by donors, it could be individuals and faith communities,
yes,
right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes,
that's really what I was getting at is how can people kind of help out?
Yes, and
yes. Lots of individual donors and kind of with our structure, we do have member congregations. So a lot of friends of all faiths and denominations, but a lot of them have become members over the years. I can't remember the exact number. It's like 80 plus, I think, in the area, which is, you know, there are a lot in our area.
Yeah, totally.
And a lot of them, you know, based on size and membership, you know, they give what they can. But then they know that if they have someone coming to them in crisis, they can reach out to us to kind of do that legwork. Because talking with a landlord, negotiating with a landlord, working with a utility company, that is definitely a skill, and knowing mm-hmm. who you need to ask.
And it's daunting.
Yes. So, and with that, I do want to say the amounts we're able to assist are a direct result of the kind of contributions mm-hmm. we get. So that does vary from time to time. We have historically had very minimal overhead, like 97% of our budget goes directly into programs. Mm-hmm. Most of our programs are open 9 to noon, Monday through Friday. We try to get a lot done in a little amount of time because we know, you know, rent and utilities, that's expensive. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that can solve that is money.
Yes.
So we try to make sure as much of that as possible can go to people.
Mm-hmm. How can everyday people, because on this podcast, we want to highlight everyday people making impacts in their community. So we're all everyday people. Yeah. How can people who don't work in this space help you help the neighbors? How can we prevent homelessness? How can we help awareness?
Yeah, I think, you know, there are a million different ways. I think, a lot of people in situations a lot of times feel very kind of alone and don't really know what to do. And I think just, you know, being a friend and seeing people as people goes a long way, and being able to encourage them to seek help early, because the earlier they do reach out, the easier it makes. Because some programs that are available that we might refer someone to, you know, they can take a little bit of time. So as early as possible is always great. I think, we have, you know, groups can always do supply drives because, we have a furniture and furnishings program. And, I speak for myself. When I go grocery shopping, things are definitely getting more and more expensive.
Certainly, mm-hmm. certainly.
And especially if you're on a limited income, like Social Security or something, those mm-hmm. things get very expensive. So, you know, even that's as simple as, you know, picking up an extra of something here and there, a shampoo or detergent mm-hmm. or shaving cream, you know, little things like that. Or, when you are, you know, spring cleaning time and you're cleaning out your home, you know, there might be an organization that can use that and get that to a family. And I think, you know, also, you know, just being aware of, you know, what's happening. And I think a lot of the scariness comes from not knowing. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know that eviction is like a 40 plus day process. You know, they might get an initial, you know, you're late on your rent. A couple days later, you might get a what's called like a pay or quit notice, which is called like most are 5 day pay or quit notices. And they're worded kind of scary if you haven't seen them before. You might think, oh gosh, in 5 days, I have to be out. But there's a lot more to it than that. Mm-hmm. You know, after those 5 days, you have to, you know, if you still haven't paid, then there's a court summons. And that's usually a week or two later. Mm-hmm. And then at court, you know, you can show up to court and you might get more time that way. Or if and then at court, you know, if the landlord does get judgment, usually then there's another 10-day grace period mm-hmm. before the landlord can actually file for a writ of possession, which is when the sheriff comes and changes the locks. And even with that, in Virginia law, up to 48 hours before the sheriff coming, you can still pay and stay in the home. So it's not an immediate thing, but it is important to get started early. And I think with other programs like utilities, there's a new program that got launched for AEP and Dominion Energy customers in Virginia called PIP. Mm-hmm. And it's targeting low-income customers where they can apply, and their utility bill, their electric bill, is limited to, I think, 10% of their monthly income. Mm-hmm. Which, especially for people on those fixed incomes,
mm-hmm. yeah.
is a game changer.
Totally.
So I think, you know, trying to let people know, you know, encouraging them to seek assistance. And, you know, when you are shopping or at a store, you know, pick up an extra. If you're at church and they're taking up for an organization, you know, put some money in there if you can. Mm-hmm. I think every little bit can go pretty far. I think, you know, I've stopped writ of possessions with $50 before.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And, you know, sometimes that really is as close as people are. I think sometimes people think, I can't give thousands, so it's not worth it.
Right.
It really is every little bit
pay
matters.
Something. Every dollar
yes.
counts.
Pay something.
Yeah.
Yes, and it adds up, and it really is, you know, a life changer for mm-hmm. people.
Mm.
kind of their lifeline.
Yeah, I love that simple example of whatever you're getting at the grocery store, get two of a couple of things. Mm-hmm. Anyone can do that. Mm-hmm.
Hey friends, let's talk about real impact. Imagine a single mom struggling to keep her family together or a child sleeping on the floor because they don't have a bed. Now imagine you being able to meet that need. That's exactly what happens every day through Care Portal.
Care Portal is a platform that connects real-time needs from local children and families to people like you, churches and individuals who want to make a difference. With just a few clicks, you can step in, meet a need, and build a meaningful connection that changes lives.
This isn't just charity. It's the church and the community coming together, showing up in love and action. So if you're ready to turn compassion into action, visit careportal.org and see how you can be a part of the movement, because connection changes everything.
Visit careportal.org for more information on how to sign up and start meeting the needs of children and families in your own zip code. Once again, that's careportal.org.
Thank you, Care Portal, for sponsoring the Mended Futures podcast.
So there was a stat on Interfaith Outreach's website that was staggering to me. It was unsheltered homelessness has increased 322% in Central Virginia since 2019. You are working directly with people impacted by this statistic. How do you manage that on a personal level?
So our community, unfortunately, has lost a few shelters the last few years. And due to some much needed renovations, the shelters are available, have lost some bed spaces. Luckily, we have some new shelters opening soon, which I'm excited about.
Nice.
But it's harder to reach people if they're not in a shelter. And it's harder for them to access services. And so, what we try to do, if we can, help them towards that first month's rent as quickly as possible, getting them moved into home, kind of keeping that home mm-hmm. is paramount. As soon as they can get in, then it's easier to, okay, now we can breathe, focus on other things, look towards employment.
Mm-hmm.
I think it can feel overwhelming, but I think just knowing, we are doing what we can, what's within our, kind of mm-hmm. within our power mm-hmm. to do. Because I know, I'm doing my best to make these positive impacts, and I feel good about that. I feel good about that work I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, the more we can do, the easier it is on these people. Because once you get out, you're a lot easier to get jobs, mm-hmm. cook your meals, all those sorts of things. And, by providing furniture, that's a big expense to help these people. Because mm-hmm. if you're unsheltered, you definitely don't have anything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I
want to dig into the vocabulary of some things that you're saying here, because I'm a former educator. And again, if you don't live in our community or if you don't work in this space, you may not understand some things. There's a difference between being an unsheltered
yes.
homeless person. Talk about unsheltered versus sheltered homelessness.
Yes.
I have another question after that. So tell folks, when you use this term, what does that mean?
Yeah. So unsheltered, that means you are sleeping in the forest, in a tent, in your car, outside, somewhere not meant for human habitation. Mm-hmm. You are not meant to live there.
Which, that's a thing. There mm-hmm. are tent camps. There are people on sidewalks. There are people outside. There are plenty of people in their cars. So there are unsheltered homeless neighbors all around us.
Yes, and that's super scary, especially during the winter when it gets really cold, because if you don't know where to go, what do?
Right.
And so, those people outside trying to make it by, wherever they found that is safe for them, if they need to access food services, they then have to make their way there, which mm-hmm. a lot of times, for most people, it's walking.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a car, if you're outside, you might not be able to afford gas. So mm-hmm. if you have a car, it's stuck somewhere and you have to then walk to wherever you need.
Yeah.
And so, if you're sheltered, you have a bed, you can take a shower, you can get clean. They usually serve meals. the playing field is different then.
In the sheltered homeless population, we think of homeless shelters.
Yes.
Could you be homeless and living with a friend? Could you be homeless and bouncing from couch to couch? Like, what's the definition of homeless?
So it depends on who you ask. Okay. The definition we operate under with homeless prevention, which we have to be very intentional about those definitions, mm-hmm. Working with the state, someone who is living with someone else doubled up, couch hopping, those sorts of things, they are not considered homeless. They are able to stay somewhere that is meant for human habitation. Mm. And those are people that those are probably the most frequent people we're working mm-hmm. with in homeless prevention. Yes, so by our definitions and a lot like HUD definition, they are not considered homeless. But the reality is, a lot of times they don't have a space of their own in mm-hmm. those homes. Mm-hmm. And so we still want to get them into something of their own quickly. Because
they're very vulnerable.
Yes.
But people in shelters, homeless shelters, mm-hmm. are sheltered homeless
yes.
people. So there are lots of nuances yeah. here. And then I caught something that you said, the continuum of care.
Yes.
I absolutely want you to talk about that because I'm so proud that this community has the continuum of care and it needs to be highlighted and it needs to be applauded. And I would love to see other categories create some coalitions. There's an amazing food coalition. Mm-hmm. There's an amazing homelessness coalition. And you could model some other things after the coalition. So can you talk a little bit about the continuum yeah. of care?
Yeah. So the continuum of care, there are continuum of cares all across the country. And it's a fancier way to say pretty much your homeless response system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it goes from, you know, our homelessness hotline, CHIA, which is Coordinated Homeless Intake and Access, who, you know, anyone their housing is either at risk or they are without housing can call that number. It also includes our local shelters, including domestic violence shelters are heavily involved. Also includes, you know, our veteran systems that work and veterans. There's a specific veteran prevention program and a veteran homeless response program, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. It includes, you know, programs like homelessness prevention, and then there are also programs for people who are actively homeless. A lot of those are called like rapid rehousing programs, where they work to get people in, very similar to our homeless prevention program, where they work with them, get them to housing, kind of a shorter term program, and then they're able to step away once they bridge that gap. So, and then there's a permanent supportive housing, which is more longer term for people with kind of more long term challenges that might have a longer history of homelessness. That just need increased supports.
Are there outreach workers?
Yes. Oh my gosh, how could I forget?
Well, I was hoping, and I'm sorry, I got excited there, but there are visible homeless
yes.
examples, and I think our community needs to know that there are outreach workers
yes.
who are having regular connections and probably meaningful relationships.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. There is specifically a street outreach program. Our lovely friends with Community Access Network are the ones who host that program. And they have a dedicated worker whose entire job is going out in the community and meeting with people who are unsheltered and trying to get them connected with appropriate programs and resources that they need to be able to be successful. And they're wonderful. They, and a lot, I think what's really important with that too, is I think you might see someone who's visibly homeless and they very much are working with someone. But if you are homeless, you know, you might have a history, you know, be some distrust there. I think we talked earlier about, you know, building that trust with the people we work with. And if someone's actively homeless, they might, you know, have some distrust for a lot of systems like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it takes time sometimes to build that relationship and that trust. And, you know, there also might be some mental health challenges involved. And so, you know, there are very much are people that are out working with those people and trying to do it in the right way, in a way that they want and are excited about.
With dignity.
Yes. Because it all, in all of these programs, client choice is a huge part of it. Mm. You know, there could be a rundown apartment and, you know, it'd be really easy just for us to say, you're in here and you're in here and you're in here. But if they don't want that, they're not going to be successful. They're, you know, it's not worth our time. And it's not worth their time because they don't want to be there. Mm-hmm. And so it's a huge part of, you know, where do you want to be? Which part of town? Do you want to be out in the county? Do you want to be in the city? You know, does this place seem like it'd be a good fit for you? You know, there are realistic expectations of, you know, well, this place is not willing to work with your situation. But, you know, there is some choice there. You know, you like this house. Let's help with the property. Let's mm-hmm. see if that would work out. Because we want people to be excited about what they're doing because it's their home.
mm-hmm. Are there unhoused people who are choosing to remain unhoused? And how does that process work?
I think it's a complicated answer. I think everyone wants a home and space that they feel safe. I think there are people that don't necessarily want to be enrolled in a program mm-hmm. or something like that. And I think they want to be able to find success on their own and are not at a point where they're wanting to work with a program right mm-hmm. now. I think, you know, one of the cool things about the continuum of care meetings is a lot of times they'll share success stories, you know, de-identified, that sort of thing, or with client permission. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they take some time, knowing that you're not someone that's going to abandon them first mm-hmm. chance. You know, mm-hmm. you really are in it with them and wanting them to be successful. So I think there are some people that might not be at the place yet to want to get into housing of their own. Mm-hmm. But I think everyone wants somewhere they can feel safe and secure. Mm-hmm.
It's a good answer.
Fair.
Mm-hmm. Totally. So the name of this podcast is the Mended Futures Podcast. And that's it's come to so many different sort of definitions mm-hmm. for us, and we've experienced it in different ways with our various guests. But I feel like today, especially for me, it's coming from the question of, are you the product of a mended future? It's coming from a place of, we're curious about where helpers like you come from, you know, like what kind of background do you have? Why do you feel connected to this kind of work? Does that make sense?
Yes. I think for me, I grew up in a low-income household. You know, both my parents worked, but, you know, there would be times it just wouldn't be enough. Mm-hmm. I think I was really lucky in that I had very strong family support. We had a pretty close family from a small town, to where if, you know, my parents weren't quite able to make ends meet, you know, there was some family that could sometimes step in, not always, but could sometimes come in and help us out on a temporary, and then my parents could pay them back, that sort of thing. And I feel very lucky with that because I don't know what we'd have done without it. You know, mm-hmm. growing up, you know, there were things that I don't think got too hung up on growing up, but like most of the time growing up, I did not have, you know, a computer until college mm-hmm. and, you know, didn't have cable any of that time or internet because those were luxuries and just not a priority. Mm-hmm. I remember in high school we first started having to type our papers. For a while, you could kind of handwrite and then have mm-hmm. to start typing. I didn't have a computer. My dad worked long hours. My mom did not have access to transportation. We were from a small town, did not have public transportation. Mm-hmm. So I could not just go to the library because there'd be no way for me to get there or get home. Mm-hmm. And so I remember, you know, before it got trendy, my mom found a old typewriter at a Goodwill.
Yeah.
And so I was in high school.
You learned to type on a typewriter.
Typing my papers on a typewriter.
Wow.
And so I feel really lucky that we had these family supports because I don't know what we would have done without them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we were one of those households that were working paycheck to paycheck mm-hmm. and don't know what we would have done without it. Mm-hmm. I feel very lucky that a lot of my colleagues also come from, you know, grew up being low income and mm-hmm. some people that I work with, you know, have experienced homelessness themselves. And, you know, I think our lived experiences with poverty and homelessness, those sorts of things, you know, I think it makes us more effective in the work we do.
Mm-hmm. Cause you we get know it. What fears We've been there. That people are going through. Yeah.
And I want to highlight one aspect of something that you talked about. I live in the region, but I don't live in the city. And there is a very big difference between urban poverty and yes. rural poverty. So if you live in the city, there's public transportation typically in a city. Lots of things are walkable. I've worked in 3 different school settings, and the one that worried me the most was farther away from mm-hmm. a city. And if it's not coming out of the public school, a lot of times the families don't have access to whatever the resource is. Mm-hmm. And so I always have a special place in my heart for rural poverty, because mm-hmm. if you don't have a vehicle.
Yeah, it's so much more isolated.
Oh, man, it is so isolating. And I watched, and once you learn more about it, you know what to watch for. When people get evicted from the cities, they go out to the rural areas because the rent was cheaper, and the transients of the same families back and forth was just heartbreaking to me. So I hear you when you say, you know, if I didn't have it, there was no transportation, there was no, and when you're trying to help a family overcome some things that have been happening for generations, you know, we always try to teach financial literacy. And I can't tell you how many families, there was never a cash exchange. There was never, they didn't have a car. So how could you talk about car insurance? Or how could you talk about credit? Or how could mm-hmm. you?
From a teaching standpoint.
Right.
Yeah.
From an educator standpoint. So I want to highlight for listeners that there are many different types of poverty, mm-hmm. many different vulnerabilities depending on where you live. And none of it's good.
No. I mean, I think especially with people on fixed incomes like disability or Social Security, like, you know, if you're disabled and you're getting disability, you probably can't do any type of work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you said, if you're out in the county without public transportation, you know, sometimes arranging that transportation is very expensive. You know, let's say you get $1,000 a month, which would be more than a lot of our clients mm-hmm. make. And let's say your rent's $700, which is cheaper than most. Mm-hmm. That leaves you $300 to arrange the transportation, get those things that your SNAP might not cover, mm-hmm. you know, account for emergencies that might come yeah. up. And there's just, you can only budget so much.
There's nothing to budget.
Right. Yeah.
It's so daunting. Yes. It's so daunting. And I think that hope is one of the most powerful things that we can give people.
It's a resource. Yeah, it really is.
And I really think that you are probably the example of hope for a lot of people in our community, and Interfaith is, and the Continuum is.
I love all the different organizations we have, because I think such the best part is, as long as you get started somewhere, and that's, you know, I, like I said earlier, I think it's so important to get started early. I think as long as you get started and, you know, ask somewhere for help, you're probably going to then get connected to everywhere else you might need. Mm-hmm. And the initial place can't do everything. There's probably somewhere that mm-hmm. is a good fit.
I love that.
So let's say that again. One of the best ways that we can be good neighbors is make sure, if you know that a family is vulnerable or a neighbor is vulnerable, get them set up with an area agency, go to a local church, go somewhere where you know they do something.
Just start trying.
Start trying, because they will be referral partners. You know, yes. 518, if you call in and you need something from family care, or if you get connected with a counselor, or, you know, if you go to Interfaith and you are working on emergency assistance, oftentimes the agencies will be referral partners to one another. Yeah. And there's a language to navigating the system. There's a skill set. And so oftentimes, if you go to an agency for one thing, they will help you. I think of Parkview. Mm-hmm. I think of, you know, you go in for food, but you might also connect for clothing, or you might connect with Life Skills Institute. Same thing with so many other organizations. So I think that's really important. Get mm-hmm. connected early.
Yes.
And they might help. They might help navigate some of the other complicated parts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're all talking behind the scenes all the time.
Yeah.
Yesterday, I even met with 518's care navigator in that team.
So look at that.
To talk about resources
yes,
and just making sure we're all updated on what's going on.
Good. So just as a final wrap up, is there anything that you'd like the community to know, either on behalf of your clients or your fellow helpers?
I think just the importance of getting involved, whether it's as volunteer, donating monetarily, donating items, old furniture, there's a place for it somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way that you can make a big impact, mm-hmm. no matter who you are or where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
Your executive director told a story or tells a story of someone who used to write a check every month
yes.
for how much? $5?
Yes.
I think it was $5, and it came regularly.
Yes.
Even if you could donate one furniture item, even if all you could
shampoo.
Do is $5, even if you just tell your neighbor to reach out
mm-hmm.
for a service, you can do something.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, everyone. Yeah. Yes, I know exactly who you're talking
mm-hmm.
about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You've
enjoyed talking
me.
To you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Mended Futures podcast, hosted by Allison Jordan and Taylor Melvin, produced by Liam Chafin, Sue England, Allison Jordan, Robert Day, Sully Jugar, and Taylor Melvin. You can find us on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to like, share, and subscribe to see more.